Thanks, Bill. Good morning, Chair Imeson, members of the board, State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection, Oregon Department of Forestry. With me today is Interim Deputy Chief Russ Lane. He started his career in 1987, June 15th of 87, 32 fire seasons under his belt coming this year, and we're just wondering about maybe 8 more years to sit in front of the podium here as an option for you. We'll see how that goes.
The guarantee is none of us will be here anymore.
Russ brings a lot of experience to the state office, started in the state office here in Salem 2 years ago, April 2017, serving as fire operations manager. This year, stepped up with Ron Graham, my deputy chief, focusing on the BLM work, which was a recommendation coming out of the fire program review to organize that agreement into the future. Russ has stepped into that the place as a deputy chief and has been serving fantastic for us this year. I appreciate your effort here, Russ, and he'll take the details here of the fire season, and I'll add some comments along the way. And I think I would like to highlight State Forest Authority's opening comments. Did mention 700,000 acres on ODF. That was for all jurisdictions. ODF is at 70,000 acres for clarity. And we have a slide to detail that.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Imeson, State Forest Authority, members of the board. Again, for the record, I'm Russ Lane, Interim Deputy Chief of Fire Protection, and thank you for the opportunity to come talk about the fire season with you this morning. I have some objectives for the presentation today: update the fire danger, weather outlook, and current drought conditions, provide an overview of significant ODF fires and trigger events since the last update you received, review the year-to-date statistics versus the 10-year average, and then share preliminary year-to-date financials. And I will emphasize preliminary as we're still gathering data both on fire statistics and financials. And where we deviate from some numbers you've seen already, I'll try and point those out. Starting with the significant fire potential outlook, in the lower left-hand corner there, we have July. Most of the west in above normal wildland fire potential. You can see the increased severity in the middle slide during August, and going into September, again, a significant amount of Oregon, most of the forest land in Oregon, is above normal on significant fire potential. Our fire danger indices are at or near 20-year maximums, sustained high to extreme fire potential for large costly fires. We have just stepped down from 30 days at preparedness level 5, but are still at preparedness level 4, significant regional fire potential. I would highlight Northwest Oregon remains in above normal fire potential and high fire danger there that quickly ramps up to extreme when we get offshore flows.
Russ, I'll add that the preparedness level is a national rating in terms of the significant fire potential on the landscape and movement of resources. And being in preparedness level 5 is the highest level. That's when we stand up a multi-agency coordination center out of Portland, in which I serve on that seat, and have a designee up in Portland helping mobilize resources to the highest priority fires.
Moving into the weather for September, our outlook issued August 31st by the National Weather Service. The chart to the left there is indicating below normal precipitation for much of Oregon and average to above average temperatures throughout the month of September. Drought status is breathtaking. I highlight the part in Northeast Oregon there that is merely abnormally dry. The remainder of the state is in moderate to severe drought, with an area there in the central Southern Cascades trending towards extreme drought. So much of Oregon in significant drought at this point. Fires on the landscape. These ones you were exposed to in your July 2018 updates. We'll touch on them just very quickly. The Graham Fire in Central Oregon was a FEMA-eligible fire managed by an Oregon Department of Forestry incident management team. Lobster Creek near Gold Beach, also managed by an ODF incident management team. The substation fire was a FEMA fire, had BLM and Oregon State Fire Marshal presence. That was the first or maybe the second of significant wheat fires that have impacted over 300,000 acres in Oregon this year. And then finally, the Silver Creek Fire, which was a smaller type 3 incident out in Oregon's Gem, Silver Falls State Park, and was in a remote canyon that took a lot of effort to suppress that fire in North Cascade District. I mentioned trigger events earlier. There were three significant events, and this early lightning storm, over 7,000 strikes in the Cascades in central eastern Oregon, resulted in the Graham Fire. Another second significant lightning event in southern Oregon around July 15th to 16th spawned several fires that are still on the landscape today, including Klondike, Miles, and other fires that are still out there with us. A third significant event affected central eastern Oregon out here in the August 16th, 17th range that brought several fires that you may not have heard their names as familiar to us, and I'll mention why, but a lot of those fires were caught and extended in an initial attack, but a significant fire load. Southern Oregon, have a contrast there. Again, I mentioned those fires ignited 7/15, 7/16. So as of July 24th, many of those fires have been suppressed. Almost 200 fires on the landscape in southern Oregon originated, and most of those were caught, but several large campaign-type fires emerged, Klondike, Taylor, Grave Creek, South Umpqua Complex that became Miles. On 8/1, there was significant fire growth, and those fires expanded rapidly and in a big way. And as I mentioned, Klondike is still significantly with us on the landscape. The third event out there I highlighted that affected central and eastern Oregon was the 8/16, 8/17 lightning storm. This map depicts from a tool we use called Intera Situation Analyst, and the purple squares are emerging fires. And I woke up on the morning of 8/17 and saw all these purple squares out there with some big red infrared blobs underneath them, and was fairly concerned what the week was going to look like after that. Through a combination of aggressive initial attack, extended attack, use of severity resources, use of some pretty new technology, infrared flights to find fires through the smoke, almost all those fires were suppressed and extended their initial attack. I think the only one out there was the Stubblefield Fire. Got an incident management team for a brief amount of time. That was another of the significant wheat fires. So all the fires in the range and forest were suppressed relatively quickly from that storm under really critical burning conditions. And this is how the map shapes up as of September 2nd. You can just walk around it quickly here. South Valley Road, again, an ODF incident management team. The Graham Fire, Watson Creek Fire is now 95% contained. And I've got specific slides on several of these. Ramsey Canyon, Garner, Terwilliger, Lobster Creek, Taylor Creek, Klondike. Going into some statistics here, our year-to-date statistics that we're tracking. So we are currently at, and this is where we'll deviate a little bit. Peter had newer numbers than when this slide was prepared. We are at about 70,000 acres on ODF protection. And that's about 11% more than our average number of fires. That's about 111% of our acres burned over the 10-year average. And relative to all jurisdictions, we're tracking now about 700,000 acres on all Oregon jurisdictions. Oregon's ODF share of that represents about 10%, and that's consistent with the long-term trend that we would be about 10% of the acres burned, about half of the fires. So our number stacks up, 827 versus 1,600.
Russ, I'd add, that's an important distinction. We often talk about how's the fire season in Oregon, and we do need to separate 16 million acres of fire protection responsibility ODF has within our district boundaries to include grazing land and forest land. And then there's other just jurisdictions across Oregon that have fire protection responsibility, BLM on the east side, all of the Forest Service, which makes up about the other half of the forest land in the state, around 16 million acres. All the southeast range country, where we have the Rangeland Fire Protective Associations, and National PACS is included in that number. And as you look at the trend, that's about right. ODF protection have about half the fires across the landscape when you look at fire ignitions across the state, but have been very successful in suppression efforts at about 10% of the acres burned for a number of reasons.
Thanks, Doug. Another depiction of acres burned here against the historical look back. So again, about 69,000 to 70,000 acres and growing. 13,000 of those acres coming from human-caused fires, about 43,000 coming from lightning fires. Going to focus in a little, with a little tighter look at a few of these fires. So the Garner Complex, again, new since the July 2018 update to the board. Near Grants Pass, started from the July 15th lightning storm. 95% contained by August 30th. Significant National Guard presence there. Three ODF-ordered teams rotated through this fire. So initially managed by Chris Klein's team two, then Joe Hessel's team one, finally closed out by the Florida Red Team that we mobilized in when we were fully committed, and we brought a state of Florida incident management team in, a type one team. Taylor Creek also was originally part of the Garner Complex, and Chris Klein's team managed this initially, but it was closed out by an interagency type one team. 10 miles west of Grants Pass, again from the July 15th lightning storm, 95% contained on August 30th, almost 53,000 total acres, 16,000 of which were ODF protection, so private and primarily BLM protection there, I believe. Miles Complex initially started out as a number of different fires, Miles, Sugar Pine, Snowshoe, Columbus, that ultimately merged. This fire was 7 miles northeast of Trail, again, the July 15th storm. Miles, almost 50,000 acres, 13,000 of that being ODF protection. The Snowshoe, 3,800 acres, almost 1,800 or just over 1,800 acres of ODF protection. The lead incident management teams here were interagency teams from the Northwest and Montana, but fully integrated with ODF command and general staffs. So the leadership core of Joe Hessel's team one initially integrated there, and the fire was closed out with Link Smith's Team 3 Command and General Staff Corps, and a fully integrated command structure there. Was a little unique for us, but worked very well. South Valley Fire near Duffer was human-caused. Chris Klein's team got one whole day of rest. I think State Forester Doherty mentioned some of the workload Team 2 had this year. Had one whole day of rest between a tough assignment at Garner and taking on the South Valley fire. And it ignited on August 1st, and they had it fully contained by August 10th, which is just a pretty incredible piece of work there.
Russ, I might add a little clarity on the team deployments and what that looks like to the agency. Often you'll see the fire protection division here given the fire briefings, but the reality of how we get our business done is all employees within this agency participate in the fire program when the fire bell rings. Our incident management teams are in the range of 30 to 33 individuals assigned to those incident management teams. They immediately deploy and we immediately follow with all the cache systems report support, the kitchens, the showers, the pumps. We have people that follow in that capacity, the IT functions, and all the support functions, division supervisors and task force leaders from the ranks of the agency. So each deployment, we're in the range of 80 to 100 ODF employees deployed to any single fire, to give you some context of what it takes to make that happen. And with the permanent staff in the range of 600 employees, you can do the math. It's in the 15 to 18% range of employees that are deployed on these fires. And we've had multiple fires throughout the fire season. So a lot of credit points to the Protection Division, and I'm always recognizing it as an agency effort. State Forest, private forest, admin, folks behind me here in the room make this all happen. And I just want a shout out to the effort that's provided throughout the ranks of this entire agency.
Okay, moving on here to the Ramsey Canyon Fire. So this fire started August 22nd, 12 miles north of Eagle Point. This is in a piece of the fire environment down there. We've had some fairly substantial fires, Hull Mountain, East Evans. So a number of fires over my career there. Team two, again, had this fire under slightly different leadership. Chris Klein was busy with the Terwilliger fire in his district, and so Joe Hessel and Link Smith took command of Team two and brought them through this. Just a great stop under some of the worst burning conditions we've had all summer. And they just flat fought fire here. They didn't get a weather break. They just went and put this out. Started August 22nd, and they had it 95% contained by August 31st.
I think this photo really tells a story of the complexity that firefighters face when you look at the proximity of those homes and how we're able to protect those structures, minimize the acres burned. 1,900 acres on this fire easily could have been in the tens of thousands. We had the aircraft, and the immediate response was fantastic. This could have been far worse. And you can see that in the photo there, the conditions in which we're burning.
Watson Creek Fire was 13 miles west of Paisley. Again, in another place we've experienced some pretty large, tough fires. Started August 22nd, managed by an interagency team with a branch provided by ODF EOA, organized a branch, Klamath Lake District, of personnel kind of from across the state. The fire is 95% contained as of September 2nd. Of the 58,000 total acres, it burned almost 12,000 of private ODF protection.
I think this is also a fire to highlight the recognition as we consider costs and exposure here, the landowner loss. Can be 10 times the value of suppression or better. In this particular fire, you'll see 11,000 acres of private land. That's one landowner loss, and that's Green Diamond Company. So that's a significant impact to one individual landowner company within the state of Oregon. All the fires we talked through, I don't want to diminish any of that. Those are all losses also to those private lands and the public lands that we protect.
The Terwilliger Fire is one of the fires that's persisting on the landscape, burning to the southeast into the Three Sisters Wilderness, 30 miles east of Springfield. It has threatened but not burned private land. It's taken a lot of effort by the district, the incident management team, to coordinate and keep that fire off private land, but it is right up against the private. 23% contained as of September 2nd, 8,446 acres. Still a strong effort going on there to bring fire out to containment lines and as much as possible eliminate the threat to that private land that's immediately adjacent. Finally, on the fire rundown, seems like a lot here. These are the Labor Day weekend fires beginning on August 31st. There were a series of fires beginning down in Southwest Oregon District, milepost 54. Looks like associated with a vehicle along I-5. That fire took a heavy air attack, aggressive extended attack to catch it. This series of fires depicted in this photo, this is a picture from the air attack, were in Douglas Forest Protective Association, right at the north end of the district there near the Lane County line around the community of Curtin. Total of 6 fires started along the freeway here, and you can see what that looked like that day. What's hard to pick up here is logging slash harvest units all back up in here that made these fires have incredible potential. 2 of them merged and got to 95 acres, but they were able to pick those fires up, again, with active, aggressive initial attack.
I think this is another one to highlight in recognition. Little known fact, this is not completely uncommon for us to see a series of fires along the highway. The last one I recall, 2015, where we had 7 fires in the same range, dragging a chain, brake failures for vehicles. Don't know that they're sending out SPACs. We pick up a fair bit of fires in this way. And the dramatic, I think that this picture tells a full story, is this feels like a lightning event for us, where we have a human-caused fire, ignition, but multiple stats. That's a lightning event where the response is difficult because fire can be spread out across a long range of the country until someone pulls that person over. So I would encourage you all to wave somebody down if you're seeing anything like this happen, and that's often what happens. Folks don't know it, but everyone around them can see it following.
As this event unfolded and DFPA was starting to get their hands around these fires at 163, they had an active night shift staffed for these fires. The Hugo Road fire took off just north of Merlin. Much of that night shift was pulled to respond to the Hugo Road fire. That fire threatened on the afternoon or evening of September 2nd, threatened a total of about 700 homes. 200 of those homes were in full level 3 evacuation, with people having to leave their homes, another 300 in level 2 set, and another 200 in level 1 ready. So a total of 700 homes threatened. That quequickly got us to FEMA eligibility, so we were able to pull that together the next morning. All these fires are now in mop-up, and again, just really fine firefighting and great stops there.
Well, I'll take this slide. It's related to also from the fire program review recommendation to look at smoke management rules. It's related here because this is the tools and indicators we use for air quality. So wanted to highlight the top slide photo there is what I attach in my emails to the board when we have these trigger events, or when we see trigger events like lightning coming and change in conditions I've been reporting out. And I've added these links as air quality has been an important and critical topic for wildfires, and also for, as I mentioned earlier, the recommendation on the fire program review to take a look and adjust our current rules around smoke management for prescribed burning during the off seasons in the fall and the spring. These are tools that are used, and just wanted to highlight and recognize that the smoke is carried from all those fires in the Northwest across the country, and really concentration range from British Columbia down to California, a little bit Southwest is where the smoke's been coming from for much of the season.
Doug, real quickly here, I want to touch on the financials to date. So year to date, we mentioned a number around $90 million. Unfortunately, that continues to climb every day. And we have a comparison there of gross large fire costs over the last 10-year period. So currently second only to 2013 in gross costs. The main number I wanted to pick out of here was the net cost after reimbursables, other agency billings, FEMA reimbursement. Will be right now we're right around $40 million on the net is where we're sitting today. The nuance here, the reason this slide was built this way is this trend line predicts the number of districts that have EFC claims on average over time, back to right back there at the beginning of my career that Doug was talking about. So almost a 30-year history here. Back at that time, about between 3 and 4 districts would end up with EFC claims. This trend's been steadily rising to where we're almost around 7 of our 12 districts into the emergency fund on an annual year-to-year basis, which is seems like a significant trend line, gets to financial workload for us.
I think also a trigger point on the finances, still growing, still potential. Typically, fire season winds down at the end of September, can stretch into middle of October at times before we get those season-ending event. Currently, no weather predictions for us for a season-ending event through September. So we'll expect to be active through the month. We're sitting at $40 million net exposure to the state after recoveries from FEMA, other agency billings, and the BLM agreement. Our gross exposure is double that at 8 or a little bit more than that, closer to $90 million. So we'll work to get those recoveries. But what's significant to note in the net exposure of $40 million is we're bumping close towards our $50 million deductible on the insurance policy. And we've outreached to Lloyd's of London on that topic already.
And a few final thoughts here to wrap up. Despite the severe conditions really that we've experienced statewide almost all season, there have been a lot of successes we'd like to highlight. The key one being really what our adequate level of protection is about. So district initial attack and extended attack effectiveness has been just consistent throughout the summer. The engagement of severity resources, so we've been able to utilize some additional aircraft, Canadian tanker group that came from our partners to the Northwest Compact, engines and hand crews from one of our great state partners in New Mexico that we mobilized through severity, and then our normal complement of severity aircraft and our severity hand crew have all been key throughout the summer. The ODF incident management teams have really stepped up to the plate this summer and been actively engaged. Like we talked about, 7 deployments, and they've quickly taken fires off the landscape and have shown the effectiveness of our system in doing that. And then finally, this isn't unique. It's with us every year, but always like to highlight the consistency of landowner, operator, and contract involvement in our complete and coordinated system. That's really what, is the cornerstone foundation of what we do. Also 2018 is on track to exceed the 10-year averages in both number of fires and acres burned by significant amounts. Settling the financials from the 2018 season will be a substantial workload. That $90 million of gross and $40 million of net is going to be a huge workload for our finance folks to process through this off season, and it will stretch their capacity. Their work is just beginning as we close out the season. And just leave you with, as Doug said, a few chapters remain to be written in the 2018 fire season story.
We always close with this slide. I took a moment to recognize internal, the staff, because I think that's really important. But a complete and coordinated system absolutely recognizes that it takes all partners. And this is a challenge for all Oregonians to address. And we've been lockstep with our partners across the board in coordination to do our business. And we can't do our business in minimizing acres, minimizing cost, and minimizing loss to our landowners without the coordination that takes from all partners. So with that, we'll take any questions.
Questions or comments?
Good. Thanks for the presentation. Always appreciate it. In Eastern Oregon, there's been a conversation about the lengthening of the fire season and the effect that it has on the kind of community seasonal hires. In particular, in Northeast Oregon, there's been a long tradition of using teachers that are now going back to school and not able to cover this longer fire season. Is that something you're experiencing across the state? And are there any sort of thoughts on how to deal with that?
Absolutely. We are seeing more active fires in the spring. May has been an active month for us since 2013, but perhaps we hadn't seen that number of fires in the past. So we don't have the access to those types of seasonal employees. I think diversity is important. We'll always use that sector for capacity. And we have returning teachers, as you example, you know, from across the state who play a big role in fire protection for us in the summertime when they're done with the students. They want to come out and fight fire, and that's been really helpful for us. But this is the time that we'll see a lot of teachers, but also college students start rolling out. I would suggest on the shoulder seasons, that's where the contractors have a role to help fill that gap in that capacity. But certainly as agencies across the board that I speak with, we all experience that with our seasonal hires because of that, some of the limitations that they bring to the table.
Yeah, I'd like you to comment just a little bit on interactions with our neighboring states' agencies. I know down in Southwest, for instance, the other fire names that all the residents know are Klamath and Natchez, which, you know, we don't have, like up at the north end of the state, we don't have a river dividing us, and smoke doesn't care anyway, but there are mountains dividing us. And I know that we have had a lot of, you mentioned Florida's particular partner agencies coming over to assist with us. I imagine there's a ton of coordination cross-border, even when we don't have the extra resources to necessarily assist in each other's states. If you'd just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, states coordinate on a daily basis. They truly are our partners. We share borders, and fires no borders. Russ alluded to the compact. I spoke on that before. That's in law. The Northwest Compact allows seamless and quick sharing of resources across the Northwest. All states have compacts. Outside of the compacts, we use the national system to pull those state assets in, like the Florida team, North Carolina specific overhead, and the New Mexico teams. I serve on the Western State Fire Managers, which is 17 Western states west of the Mississippi. And we coordinate on a call every couple weeks, and we share resources through that and communicate. I would describe the process as very clean. We're exercising all nooks and crannies of the policy framework in which we have to operate to access those resources. And I would also highlight, as you see the red expand in the west from Idaho to Montana, Washington, those resources are deployed in their own states. And that's when you see us reach beyond those immediate borders. And the border also extends up through Canada. Northwest Compact includes the five Canadian provinces in the Northwest. As Russ highlighted, we moved some of the tankers down from Canada with a phone call. So those agreements have been fully exercised and really are instrumental and part of the complete and coordinated system to make that work. California in particular, we've been sharing a lot of fire over the years, and you'll see the structure fires through EMAC, which is the emergency management, through our OEMs coordinating. We've seen a lot of structure fire engines crossing the borders back and forth these days. We've also had the Natchez fire that started on the 15th with that other series of fire. That's been bumping up against our border all summer, and we haven't lost sight of that and hasn't entered into Oregon. We also relied on the California state team to cover the Klamathon fire that rolled into Oregon. And then they, up until maybe this week, they were on the Klondike West, which is has some threats west to the town of Agnes. So utilizing that state team has been deployed in Oregon for 2 weeks. So seamless.
Other topic, I think early in your presentation, you referred to sort of the prescribed fire air quality rules. Do you have any observations? We recently had a joint hearing down in Medford that erupted pretty spectacularly. You want to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, this to me is the power of the people. People are speaking and are trying to find solutions to breathe in this much smoke during wildfire seasons. And one of the strongest antidotes is well known as prescribed burning in the spring and the fall. And we're reviewing that policy now. And the board and the EQC set that in motion. Environmental Quality Commission and the Board of Forestry has set that in motion. The committee review work was completed with a recommendation for policy change back to the Board of Forestry. Board of Forestry added your comments to adjust those rules. And that goes out for public hearing as you referenced. We had 5 public hearings, very well attended, and that's where I mentioned the power of the people. Folks are very interested in this topic and seeking solutions to mitigate smoke from wildfire and move towards introducing fire as a component forest management, moving towards more active forest management across the landscapes. And we're hearing that, and that will influence the policy change. We'll absorb that feedback through these public hearings and be back to the Board of Forestry and again through the EQC to adopt in the state implementation plan. I would suspect with this fire season and to absorb that information, we'll be targeting early next year. January, perhaps, board meeting to consider that. Early thoughts were perhaps we may be prepared for November, but given where we're at in terms of ability to manage staff work beyond fighting fire, I would suspect January would be the time we'd be returning to the board for that policy consideration.
Any other questions, Mike?
Just a concern with Peter's opening remarks and thank you for the presentation. I heard several times throughout the presentation and in your remarks of lack of help. Is there anything that this board, looking forward, can do to help mitigate that problem? I mean, obviously the fire seasons aren't going to give us a break.
Some of that is also a budget issue, and you know, we do have we're in that process now of having submitted the policy option packages that we have that include you know, some more robust funding, especially related to the fire side of things. Peter?
Yeah, so the, you know, as Tom mentioned, you approved our budget moving forward, our agency request budget. The next step is to see the governor's recommended budget, and then at that point, we will know what we can move forward with discussing with the legislature. And at that point, yes, I think the board's voice in support of the need for additional resources and the importance of those resources will be valuable in our success of gaining some additional resources in the next coming budget session.
Yes. So the fire season from a smoke perspective has been rather spectacular down in the Rogue Valley. We've probably had at least 5 weeks where we had significant health warnings straight, I mean, like every day. And there's been a lot of I don't think I'd necessarily call it public awareness because I don't think it's particularly necessarily always informed. Maybe awareness is the right word. folks are aware we're having crazy times. They don't know why. They don't know what we can do about it. They don't know what a proper solution is. But there is a lot of discussion from everybody from, you know, my neighbors to my horseshoer, wondering if we as a society have the capacity to just continue fighting and continue bailing out people that are impacted by fires. Whether there actually is the capacity to do that, both resources, people resources, and financial resources. And it seems to me that it would be worthwhile in the off season, after you've dealt with the financials, to perhaps look and do a little bit of an internal assessment. And I'm not sure all of the details necessarily that need to be examined, but we've got, you know, folks are not aware, number one, of all of the fires that are put out on initial attack. They're aware of the named fires that have gotten large and out of control and are smoking us out. So it seems like it would be worthwhile, number one, to maybe do an assessment of, I don't know, maybe three categories of fires. You know, how many of them are we putting out in initial attack? How many of them are we putting out in a slightly extended attack? And we've got a lot of fires now. It's about the first half of our news every night talks about containment lines on various fires and estimated dates when they'll be out. And there's a appalling number of them where the news reports of when they will be out is when the rains arrive. So, you know, there's the initial attack, the ones we eventually, you know, I don't know what you call them, extended attack, you get them out, but you do get them out. And then there's the ones you contain and wait for fall rains. It'd be nice to have some assessment of how many of each of those are we having. Is there any commonality or characteristics that makes a fire start more prone to be in one or the other of those categories? You know, is it location? Is it geography? Is it terrain? Is it timing of resources, you know, that we're already at capacity and so we can't deal with it? Is it weather? Obviously, we're in extended drought. You know, so is it underlying moisture conditions? But if there's some way that we can try to get a handle on defining and predicting where we're effective and where we're basically waiting for rain, that might be useful, particularly, you know, looking at the 10-year trend lines. And another couple years, the last 5 years are going to be substantially, they'll be the majority of what our last 10-year rolling average is. I'd hate to be in a 10 years down the road in a situation where we haven't really accommodated in our thought processes the changed circumstances of fire seasons that we're dealing with. The earlier snow melt, the lack of summer rain, the shoulder season extending, you know, can we try to get our hand around it? We've had, you know, there was big news recently. Walden, I think, is proposing to come up with some emergency bailout money to help reimburse people that were forced to relocate from the Rogue Valley this summer because of health concerns. And help pay for their hotel bills when they had to leave because they couldn't breathe. So we're facing a future where I don't know as a society how we're going to afford the implications of climate change on fire seasons. But it'd be nice to try to get a little bit of a strategic handle on what we're dealing with now.
Yeah, and I think we have taken that look forward, and we do keep those statistics on fires caught. That's one of our key performance measures, number of fires caught. I think the reason some of them get bigger, all of the above, a lot when you look at some of the large fires, they get started in very tough terrain. Yes. And so
I think we've kept that, and I think you know, I'd like to get beyond the anecdotal, though, and see if we can't get some definition of the conditions and some percentages associated with it and some, you know, probabilities. Because, yeah, you know, we could all, I listed a whole thing, series of things that I think probably impact what type of fire, what fire category we end up on. But it'd be nice to grab it a little more substantially in my mind. And you may already have it, and I just don't know that information. But I'd like to see it.
I think a tool to look at is the fire risk analysis that's conducted. We have a West Side, West Side, which is west of the Mississippi, review. We've initiated a web portal in coordination with OSU where we can look at fire potential fire risk for your area, and it has the historic data of acres burned and where the fires are. So that data is all.
I'm basically kind of wondering if there's any policy implications associated with that information. You know, we also had the situation where we had a private landowner meet some fire crew with a rifle and tell them they couldn't put fire line across their private property. You know, things are getting dicey out there. And so it seems like we are likely to start to bump up against resource limitations, and it'd be nice to know if there's some way we can grapple with our priorities and how we deal with it.
We've already, the grappling with resource limitations is already
happening. Yeah.
I remember going to the, you mentioned the office in Portland, the sort of interagency, the spot where people come in on a daily basis at where to mobilize people. And it used to be that it was where to, how to use new resources, and now it's how to take resources away from current fires and send them somewhere else. So,
yep. Yep.
Well, and there will be a you know, a sort of a closeout when we get there too of you know, sort of when we're hopefully through with this season of more complete report. Yeah.
And I'd also like, you know, we hear a lot of information about the grappling with resources at this end where we're fighting it. Once the fire season is over, there's a lot of, you know, fire line that's been built and stuff that's been done. I know some of it, I think there's some attention being given right now in the paper, to some of the fire lines that were built with mechanized equipment in, Cascade Siskiyou. And what are the expenses and the plans for going in post-fire season on restoration? And so that's another, you know, layer to this is how do we deal post fire with what we had to do to fight fire? And I don't have a feel for that level either, that layer, and how we deal with that. Cause I'm sure that's resource limited too.
Did you have a,
I just had one more question. With the lack of personnel that you're experiencing, this year, has there been an increase in injuries or fatalities, or and if so, I'd kind of like to see that the graph or statistics or
we'll report out on that at the next session where we finalize that data. Certainly I've had significant injuries this year, had fatality on the substation fire from a local firefighter effort there in the wheat fields in that response. That's data we can bring to the table and take a look at.
Thank you.
Thanks for the report. And thanks, Russ, for stepping up to this new and additional responsibility. And we'll be getting your next report probably at our next board meeting.